Michael Richmond is a hero.
Good afternoon, Mr. Graves.
Good afternoon.
The floor is yours.
Okay, cool. Well, I prepared a very brief summary of my evidence, which I think has been circulated. You should have a copy of that in front of you. So I'll quickly go through that. My name is Ian Greaves. I'm a planning consultant with Sullivan Planning Group, and I'm here today presenting expert planning evidence on behalf of David Barton, Plaza Investments Limited and Barina Proprietary Limited. My primary evidence has been pre-circulated in accordance with the directions of the hearings chairman. My evidence covers discrete points relating to the provisions of the proposed low-density residential zone, medium-density residential zone and high-density residential zone of the Queensland Lakes District Council's PDP. With regards to the LDR zone, I support the council officer's change to policy 7.2.6.2 that removes reference to the 100 square metre maximum commercial growth floor area from this policy. I also question the suitability of this blanket non-compliant status for all commercial activities in the LDR zone. I consider that the policy provisions provide an appropriate basis for a discretionary activity rule for commercial activities comprising no more than 100 square metres of gross floor area. I'm aware that Townsdale for QRDC has identified a scope issue with regards to this recommended rule change relating to David Barton's primary submission, 269. Whilst I cannot provide any legal expertise on this matter, I took a view that the panel would not be prevented from amending the underlying rules relating to commercial activities given the recommended rule change directly correlates to the requested policy change specified in submission 269. With regards to the MDR zone, I'm generally supportive of the themes of the proposed MDR objectives and policies that I believe will provide an appropriate planning framework to support areas of densified residential development. I recommend the rewording of policies 8.2.2.2 and 8.2.2.3 in the MDR zone to simplify the provisions and recognise different design outcomes. I also support the amendments to Rule 8.5.6, which excludes recession plan requirements for sloping sites in the MDR zone. With regard to the HDR zone, I'm supportive of the proposed HDR objectives and policies that I think provide an appropriate planning framework to support dense residential development within identified areas close to town centres. I believe that it's important that the planning provisions recognise an appropriate balance between promoting intensified development within the zone and protecting amenity values. I do recommend the rewording of policy 9.2.3.2 in the HDR zone to avoid ambiguity and visualise the associated objective and zone rules. I also support the amendment to rule 9.5.4 increasing building coverage for sloping sites from 65% to 70%. I'm happy to answer any questions on the panel.
Thank you.
Yes, I've got a couple of questions.
In terms of Section 7 and the commercial activities,
I understand what you're saying, it's very clear. The tone of the language in the plan, and even in some of the expert evidence we've received, has effectively, rightly or wrongly, adopted the thinking that discretionary activity is sort of indicating it's generally okay, a non-complying activity feels more like the exception, and at the other end, a restricted discretionary activity means it's even closer to being okay. And certainly the sense I've got from the council in support of retaining some of the non-compliant statuses that they've proposed is that the industry interprets that as being a higher bar than a discretionary activity. What are your thoughts on that? Just as a general question about using discretionary activity status and non-complying, and is one really any easier than the other to get consent or vice versa?
Well, yeah, I think that there's a clear sort of, my view is that in terms of the non-compliant status, that's only in exceptional circumstances possibly where a consent could be granted. Probably the key requirement, as we know, is that a non-complying activity is a Section 104D test in the Act, in terms of the threshold that needs to be reached to pass that. I think, relating back to the commercial activity within the low-density residential zone, I don't think providing a discretionary activity regime necessarily makes obtaining resource consent any easier, and there's going to be significant, significant issues for any applicant or any application to work through before they're likely to successfully achieve a resource consent. The things that pop to my mind would be residential amenity is critical, probably noise, traffic, car parking, those type of effects, and also residential character. So my view is the non-compliant status, whilst it is slightly harder, I don't think there'd be anything if the consent triggered a discretionary activity consent and there was particularly adverse effects created, then I don't think there'd be anything that would prevent council declining that consent or having substantial changes to actually get it over the line.
Thanks for that. In your over 10 years experience as a planner, have you ever come across a discretionary activity that was granted consent despite being either or both contrary to relevant planning provisions or having more than minor adverse effects?
I don't think so, no.
But either one or the other?
Possibly not in accordance with objectives and policies. I don't believe I've seen one that would affect any more than one. Not saying that there isn't.
No, experience. I ask that because one argument that could be made in favour of a non-compliant status is that you get that safeguard of the 104 Big D. The community knows it'll definitely be less than minor, or it'll be in the scheme of the plan, whereas in theory a discretionary activity could, being not subject to those key restrictions, could in theory be granted with much more than minor adverse effects and or serious policy defect, but that might be a theoretical thing because I'm not sure how often that really happens in reality.
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be very unlikely, and particularly when you actually relate that back to the specific objectives and policies that are drafted here, that are quite clear in terms of outcomes. So I think that's a pretty unlikely scenario.
Okay. Turning then to the meeting density stuff. So policy 8222, I think that's a paragraph 15 of your evidence, not your summary, of course. And thank you for providing us alternative wording that you prefer. I'll just wait for the team to catch up.
Yes.
Good. So your suggestion is to change the word require to encourage. What I was interested in when I read this policy, putting aside what the first word is, visual connection with the street through windows, I'm assuming it should be a comma in outdoor living areas, low profile fencing or landscape. So even if require was the word, I'm not seeing at all what the high bar is. Either the building has windows, or there's some fencing, or there's an outdoor space, or there's some landscaping planted along the boundary. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what possible land use you had in mind that you thought require could be onerous or unachievable. So what's the problem we're trying to solve, I guess?
Yeah, I just feel like it comes across too strong, and particularly when you look at it in the context of the medium density residential zone, particularly here in Wanaka, is replacing large tracts of low density residential zone where probably this outcome isn't currently achieved in the existing environment. And so to sort of put a require component into, potentially someone doing a very minor sort of activity with breaches of boundary setback, and then all of a sudden related to this policy, when you've got a receiving environment which doesn't necessarily achieve this type of street topology throughout the existing environment, that there's certain circumstances, and also related to some particular site constraints, that I'm not suggesting that it's not an important urban design outcome. I'm just suggesting that, you know, there is going to be times when, you know, certain circumstances don't promote this outcome or don't, you know, it's not a desirable sort of result. And I feel like, you know, encourage still is strong enough to achieve a sufficient outcome.
If it was put to you that encourage was limited to the council being able to say it would like to see it, but not actually able to do anything about it, because the policy doesn't, as you propose, it doesn't actually say whether it could happen or not, it just says ask nicely for it, or encourage. It doesn't say coerce, doesn't say...
I think it's probably then at that point it's in the context of what consent application's been considered and how that outcome could be achieved. You know, if it's a boundary setback breach, then does this policy really apply?
Do you think there might be wording that if it wasn't required, is there an alternative wording other than encourage that better reflected what you told us, which was generally speaking, it's probably the right thing to do, but there might be the odd exception or special case where it's not practicable or not something. I don't know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but
yeah, possibly the policy isn't worded the best as it stands at the moment.
All right, well, look, I think we can stop. I think just the discussion has given me clarity on what it is you can issue it, so that's fine for me. In terms of 8223, I can understand, again, I can understand what you're saying, and it's the usual, not the usual, but it's the common defence of, but what about that special case that a really strong policy doesn't contemplate? But then if I look at the alternative wording you put, manage the potential for garages to dominate the streetscape, that policy doesn't actually say whether dominating the streetscape is a good or bad thing anymore. It just says manage the potential. So I could argue that I've got the potential to dominate the street with my garage and I'm going to do it. Maybe I'm being a bit of a smart aleck, but I guess, again, it's that question of saying if the policy's perhaps too rigid in the first instance, I wonder whether the relief you put forward might just go too far the other way.
Possibly it should be managed the potential effects for garages to dominate the streetscape. That would be inappropriate.
Would it be something like limit the adverse effects of garages dominated?
Yeah, no, I can see
limit
that.
Doesn't mean avoid, it just means do what you can.
But the reason what brought this to my attention actually, I've recently been involved with a subdivision on Albury Road, it's called Kirribunka Heights. You may have seen that it's across the road from Skew Heights, and we had an urban designer put together the subdivision design, and part of that design included a rear lane environment. And that lane environment, the actual recommendation from the urban designer was actually garages fronting that lane. I think one of the recommendations was up to 1 metre from that lane boundary. So to me, there's certain street policies that, you know, maybe, and that's where I thought, well, the actual requirement to avoid that situation where there's certain circumstances where it's actually promoted from an urban design perspective, led me to the thinking around changing that policy.
Well, that starts off another discussion, really, in terms of the median density zone and the type of housing anticipated, and if there is a likelihood that a type of or configuration of housing, like terrace housing, that is likely to bring that kind of service lane type approach, should that actually be mentioned? Should the policy say something like, et cetera, garages along streets, except for dedicated service lanes, and actually make it clear that there might well be in that zone?
I wouldn't be adverse to that. Yep, I guess my thinking there would be it's possibly covered in pickup through the subdivision plan.
Okay.
And it's so, whilst I haven't looked at them any time recently, my understanding of when I have reviewed them is they're quite strong on design, and potentially that outcome could be provided for through those provisions.
Yeah, look, I'll share that they have all sorts of problems in Auckland with confusion about rear lanes and are they streets or not, and should they be designed for pedestrians at front doors or just carriages, and a lot of money has been spent going around the circle for that.
Can I just interrupt you? And
Just following up from that, I'm just wondering, I took my fellow commissioners around parts of Wanaka this morning, but one of the places I took them was to the development of the former primary school site,
yep.
which I know you're familiar with.
Yep.
The houses front onto primary land back onto Denby Street.
Yep.
Would those houses fronting onto Denby Street be consistent with this policy or not?
I'd need to go and look at the houses and designs. I think the answer is probably no. Because I think a lot of them off the top of my head, I haven't been down there for a month or so, as the garages are quite close to the road, and I think they do sit forward of the dwellings, if I'm...
That was my impression this morning.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
And so that it does go wider than just the service lanes.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in that case, the intention around that design is probably the orientation of north, the garages promoting them on Henry Street as the southern side of those properties, promoting the open space on the northern frontage along the lane environment. I suspect is the rationale behind it. Our colleague and wife did do the design, so he's sitting here in a couple of hours.
Well, that raises the question whether, in fact, given that circumstance on the southern side properties, is not that unlikely, whether you would consider that the policy should actually indicate those circumstances.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think my view would be there's always a risk if you have it too specific that it misses something. And so if it can be worded in a manner where it allows exceptions in the right circumstances without actually being specific to those scenarios, that probably a better outcome in terms of achieving sort of efficient and effective policy.
So then, great conversation. One way to deal with that is one extreme is a criticism that many first generation plans had, which was policies as a whole were so generic that it was hard to actually figure out what they were actually calling for and what was successful and not successful.
Yeah.
Another approach, and I think what you've tried to recommend isn't that, but it's tried to get that flexibility. Another approach could be to retain as outcome-focused policies as one is comfortable with, and I'm saying it's like the sense I've got from the council's plan is that it's tried to write a policy framework that's clearer on what's next.
Yeah, I agree.
Would it be possible, in your view, if you had six policies, five of them avoid this, require this, enable that, support, whatever, clear as day. Instead of trying to write each policy individually to have its exclusions and generalities, could you have an additional policy at the end that just said when applying the above policies, effectively, if there are exceptions or impractical circumstances, that's the pathway to effectively endorse not meeting the policy. You know what I mean? Is there a way to actually have policies telling you how to be flexible about policies so you kind of get the flexibility you're talking about but you don't lose the specificity that I think the council's promoting in its policies?
I think you run the risk with that particular developments will try and hang their hat on that. And
everyone will.
Yeah, and circumstances where it shouldn't actually be used. And I don't know how... That would be the only sort of risk I see. I mean, I think there is a policy that could be worded in that manner, I agree, but there is potential risk that it gives everybody the opportunity to water down to what the plan is trying to achieve.
Yeah, could you specify the range of circumstances?
I guess so, to the
exclusions, there may be a limited range of circumstances.
I guess that then leads back to my thinking that, my preference is it's more general because, there is a risk you miss something.
Yeah, okay. So then my last question for you is just about 9.2.3.2 and the wording you proposed, which, as I read what you propose, it flies in the face of what you've just said in a way. Because as I read the policy you've proposed, it's enable a resource contingent opportunity, sure, where the amenity values of neighbouring properties are not adversely affected. That reads to me very much as an avoid adverse effects policy, which it's hard to imagine any contravention of a rule wouldn't result in some, even if it's tiny, adverse effect. But maybe I'm not reading correctly what you've tried to put to us, but when I say are not adversely affected, I think that's pretty clear.
No adverse effect, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I take that last component to mean something different. I mean, to my thinking, an adverse effect is more than a tiny effect, is where I'm going with that. And I think what my thinking around that rule was really in relation to the objective. The objective is a reasonable degree of protection of amenity values will be provided within the context of an increasingly intensified and urban zone whose character is changing. So the idea, I guess, and I think it actually links really well, and I touch on that in my evidence, when it will, to the building height rules, where there's a restricted discretionary regime that allows for certain circumstances are allowed for a resource consent process for buildings to breach permitted building heights. My thinking on that policy, A, links back to that objective to enable the opportunity, which is sort of discussing the objective, and then I think it links, as I said, quite nicely to some of the restricted discretionary regime rules. I see what you're saying, the last five words potentially. I have to admit I struggled when trying to rewrite this. At first I actually didn't have those last five words, I've taken into consideration, but I thought that might be a bit loose. and so my thinking on adverse effect was more that, you know, I didn't consider a tiny effect would be an adverse effect. I think, you know, it would be a minor or more minor effect.
Okay. Let's understand that review, we'll take that on board. If we came to the view that we didn't agree,
mm-hmm.
but we otherwise agreed with what you're trying to achieve, if the objective uses the word reasonable, would a qualifier that could be squeezed into your text be and are not unreasonably adversely affected? That would seem to relate directly to what the objective talks about. If the objective sets reasonable as the benchmark.
Yeah, actually then it's a good addition, I agree.
Certainly think the idea of trying to use minor or less than minor in policies has been moved away from by the industry.
Yep.
But that might also be. So I think what? So this is it, for benefit this to you, if we felt that the way you've written it, we read that as saying no adverse effects at all, and we can do that, that's not reasonable or what you intended,
that's not what I'm trying to achieve.
What would you prefer to see added or changed?
I agree. I think unreasonably quickly effective is appropriate.
Well, that was nice and circular, wasn't it? Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
While we're talking about that same policy of your wording, I'm just wondering how do you enable opportunities to breach standards that are different from what's provided for in the Act? What are you intending by the enable the opportunities? What do you mean by that?
I think what I mean by that is, and it really probably links to that, the height rule, where there is an opportunity in the right circumstances to seek and possibly obtain consent to breach the permitted height rules, which is effectively that restricted discretionary activity rule ties quite nicely with that policy.
Well, that's what you're linking
yep.
with, so it's
yep.
the restricted discretionary
yep.
rule.
Yep.
Okay, I just wanted to get that clear.
Do you have any questions, Commissioner? Yes, sir.
No.
Can I ask a question?
Just following on from that discussion you had with the Chair, are you sure enable opportunities are the right words, or are you actually saying the policy should be support applications? So as long as the effects are okay. It seems like that's what you're saying, is where there's opportunities, the plan should be encouraging people to go there. So wouldn't it be better if the policy just directed everyone and the council to support them? Rather than say the height limit and you should go over it or whatever.
I'm not sure I understand the difference between enable and support.
Enable means people to make an application. Support means granting
it. Okay. Yeah, I said that. Yeah.
Well, it's your reference, huh?
No, I accept that. I mean, that's what I'm suggesting. And I think, as I actually touched on in my evidence, I was involved in a recent development over in Queenstown where we had quite a significant high breach on a high density residential site, and we had a lot of some shading diagrams, which the architect did, and it came out that it was just a better design outcome. The effects were relatively low, less than minor in this case. I don't think we didn't have written approval from one of the neighbours, and it just didn't achieve the better design outcome. So that, that's what I'm trying to say, is yes, support opportunities where the effects are managed appropriately.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Bridge. Very helpful. Cool.
Anything further?
No, that's all.
Great. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Cole.
My name is Tony Cole, I represent the New Zealand Transport Agency, and this is a summary statement of my primary evidence dated 30 September 2016. Start on paragraph 3.
Yes, I think
it would be
NZTA's responsibility.
Yes, several times. Vehicles on state highways can produce adverse effects, e.g. noise, that extend beyond the state highway boundary. Sensitive receivers, such as houses, can be susceptible to the effects of roads. Reverse sensitivity is an effect under the RMA. It follows, therefore, that there is a duty to avoid, remedy, or mitigate reverse sensitivity effects in order to achieve the RMA's purpose of sustainable management. The Transport Agency suggests responsibility lies with councils to include appropriate land use controls and district plans. Landowners, developers, should ensure buildings containing noise-sensitive activities are designed and constructed to achieve a reasonable indoor acoustic amenity. The Transport Agency supports the Council Officer's recommendations regarding the reverse sensitivity provisions within the residential chapters. Notification. Transport Agency submitted that as a road controlling authority for state highways, it should be deemed an effective party to those activities needing resource consent where the activities require access to a state highway. The Council Officer supports this recommendation and provides amendments to the rules to accommodate this. I provided suggested amendments to these rules 7.6.2.1, 9.6.1 and 9.6.2, which I suggest provides further clarity. In terms of the Franklin Medium Density Zone, Transparency has only just become aware of the minute regarding that.
Yes, I understood after you became quite late in the piece.
Yes, so just to clarify, I noticed in the second minute that it suggested that the Transport Agency first submitted in many of the submissions, which is correct, but for completeness, I'd just like to add that we provided many original submissions also to those provisions.
Yes. We would expect to hear the transport agency on the mapping section on that.
Thank you.
That was the intention. I didn't have in front of me the full list of further submissions as well.
Thank you.
Just on this issue of affected party, I raised with Ms. Lee yesterday her evidence, you may not have seen it, just agreed with your suggested proposal of saying whether written approval for NZTA has been. I raised with Ms. Lee whether the better phraseology to use might be just that the NZTA has been considered an affected person for those applications, and even as simple as that. Would that, in your view, be satisfactory?
It would be satisfactory.
The other question I've got is in terms of your discussion in paragraphs 3 and 4 of your summary. As I understood the NZTA submission, it sought whether road speed on the state highway was 70 kilometres per hour or greater, it would be an 80 metre width of noise control, if you like to use those terms,
yes.
And where it was less than 70 kilometres an hour, it would be 40 metres. Is that the position that you agree with?
That was the position that we did our submissions on. As I highlighted in my evidence, that was on an older version, which was updated about the time that Queenstown plan was modified. So in terms of that, I'm not a noise expert like Dr. Charles, but he correctly identifies the updated version that the transport agency gave.
Well, the reason I raised it, I was just clarifying that that was what was lodged, because that does limit our jurisdiction. Dr. Charles is suggesting that in some of the areas where it's 50 kilometre hour zone, it should also be 80 metres on Frankton Road, for instance. So that's why we've just clarified that that was the original submission.
It was.
Do you have any further questions?
Yeah, thank you. I've just got a couple of questions. The first is the potential downside for NZTA if we were to agree with the proposition of loading the plan with NZTA transport network related reverse sensitivity effects, not from the point of view of new houses or centre of activities that might come close to highways. It's the other situation where NZTA might want to widen a highway or significantly change it, and suddenly it's creating effects on lawfully established sensitive activities next door, and it has to use a different seal on the road, for instance. Is that something NZTA thought about and is comfortable taking on?
That's probably outside my jurisdiction in terms of that's what the engineers say, what I could design, but we have responsibility and we have managed plans, environmental plans regarding that. And, so I'm sure that that would be considered.
No, I think the last thing anyone wants to see is a situation where we unintentionally put a DTA in a situation where it can only build new motorways or widen highways if they're coal-plated and massively expensive because of policies and the plan that it helped put in place. Anyway, that was the question, that's fine. Next question is, the Act has pretty clear frameworks for identifying people as affected parties, and it's in the first instance whether adverse effects are minor or more than minor, but not less than minor. And while there's nothing wrong with a policy framework of just saying the process for any consent in these circumstances shall be X, is there any technical data or information that could give us comfort that just saying anything connecting to a highway is likely to lead to effects on NZTA that are minor or more than minor? And I'm struggling to see it myself.
Right. We submitted on those because they were sort of some activities that were deemed control condition, and they required access, or if they required access, we thought we should be deemed an affected party. And the wording around some of that in my evidence was relating to that notification aspect. So it could be an access that's currently used as a right-of-way, and it could be an additional dwelling put on it. So as a general rule, three residential dwellings would require a particular type of access. If it was a fourth dwelling, then it could be require a higher upgrade of an access just because of the vehicle use. So if we weren't an affected party, we wouldn't be able to manage that.
So am I hearing you correctly here that there are some circumstances, putting aside the resource management consent from the council, just in terms of people wanting to connect to NZTA's motorway, are there some circumstances where people can do that without needing to get effectively landowner or civil approval from NZTA? I can understand NZTA coming into the table at a resource consent if that's the only opportunity NZTA gets to manage its own network and connections to it, but I just naively assume NZTA would have a separate
process anyway. Some state highways have limited access road, so there's another set of powers under that, but we generally don't try to use those exclusively. We're outside of that in terms of land use activity or subdivision. We think it's fairer on the applicant to deal with that through the
Yeah, no, I understand doing a one-stop shop, get it all done, I get that.
So there is, in terms of your question, what I think you're asking is that there are some provisions for some of the state highways.
But not all of them.
Yes. But having said that, people cannot do works within the
So that might catch a new vehicle crossing type construction, but if someone had an existing one they wanted to pump more units on, they might get around it. That's been helpful for me. There's another provision that also talks about the need to consult with NZTA that was in there. Of course, the Act says people don't need to consult anyone for a resource consent. So again, there's a question in my mind about, isn't it an advice note saying for things like connecting to the highway, you have to talk to this group, which is probably okay, but if it's effectively trying to make consultation mandatory as part of a resource consent, that might fall down. That's your understanding?
Yes.
Okay. The reason I've asked these questions, by the way, I understand NZTA's position very clearly. It's the risk that as soon as NZTA gets these, then Historic Places says it now wants everyone to have to get its approval before they can get consent. And then the next agency comes along, and then the next thing you know, council's effectively acting as a secretary for every government ministry in the country. Which is not your problem, but that's just to give you some context of why I'm asking you these questions.
Sure. Can I explain on that? So in terms of that, it comes back to the original reason why we submitted was that there were some controlled activities that there were no one was deemed to pick up.
Yeah.
So that was our concern.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Mr. Collar. I understand what you're saying.
Pretty clear. Yeah. Just a small check before one. The 80-metre, 40-metre setback, each of the road or each of the road boundary?
We historically have used the edge of the seal. I understand the council also suggested
edge of the road reserve.
Edge of the road reserve, and equally fine with that.
Sorry, it could be either
would satisfy NZTA.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Are there any other questions?
Thank you. Matt Soderby. I'm a surveying consultant based in Wanaka, and I'm representing submissions made by my client, Mr. Dean Fountain, and also by myself. We also have made submissions relating to specific parcels of land, but understand these will be heard after the submissions on the text is complete. We've read the section 42A report, and my submission is really one of support of Council's concept. We support the concept of the 450 square metre density, which seems to be very similar to the current district plan provisions, but also thoroughly support Council's gentle density approach. To me, it makes sense that thoughtful synthetic development should be encouraged at a higher density than development which is not as rigorously assessed through the consent process. I appreciate the concept of allowing development at the 300 square metre density as a restricted discretionary process. To me, this gives a signal that appropriate residential development is likely to be acceptable, providing the matters for the discretion are managed appropriately. I understand that it's appropriate for Council to have the ability to decline inappropriate 300 square metre applications, and so the restricted discretionary status is fitting. However, I would be very concerned if the majority of such cases became bogged down in long and complicated consent applications. And I think it's vital that the matters for discretion are clear and do not create unnecessary uncertainty, which may dissuade developers from using the provisions. I consider Rule 7.5.3 restricting building height to 5.5 metres for the density less than 4 by 3 square metres to be an excellent compromise for low density zone and an efficient method of maintaining the low density nature of the zoning. My concern is that it's likely to be very restrictive for building multiple units on sloping sites at 5.5 metres high, and with this in mind, I support the status change from non-complying to discretionary and consider that this signals to applicants that additional height may be appropriate in some situations. I support the extensions of the low density residential zone as proposed and consider that it's efficient use of the land identified in the urban growth boundary. In particular, the Medicine and Old Station Ave area has been progressively developed in line with current low density residential standards, via non-complying subdivision applications due to its underlying rural lifestyle zoning. Past subdivision applications have included land use consents to erect residential dwellings on each property. These typically have been long, protracted applications with approval eventually obtained, but this has been an inefficient method of development, wasting valuable time and resources for council and the landowners involved. It's vital that sufficient areas of land are zoned to reduce the likelihood of this reoccurring. With the growing demand from both tourists and the local population requiring accommodation in close proximity to both the lake and central Wanaka, opportunities to deliver a reasonable volume of housing solutions are very limited. It's critical that land and infrastructure are used in an efficient and sustainable manner. Areas close to the urban centres and where urban quality water, wastewater and roading infrastructure are available should be prioritised for residential living. I support the proposed zoning, rezoning of the low density residential land and consider sufficient use of the land as identified within the urban growth boundary. And I support the written provisions of the proposed low density residential zone and consider they'll provide effective and efficient density of the form. The density is appropriately balanced to provide for a high level of residential demand.
Just in terms of just in terms of your paragraph 13,
yes.
I asked the council for the council yesterday to address us on how the council proposes to deal with the consent notices that are imposed on all those properties once these rules become effective,
yes.
Because otherwise
those people are still going to suffer the stuff that we have at the moment.
Not to feel safe at the moment.
So hopefully.
And was there an answer to that?
They will send they get back to us and they'll reply as to how that will be dealt with.
Great.
It's obviously not a district plan matter that we can include. I think it's important that it's dealt with.
That is something that needs to be resolved.
Any questions?
Yeah, I do have a couple. Thank you. One of the things we tested with the council staff, and it's only fair we do with you too, was the difference in the low density zone between a 300 metre density opportunity that's proposed versus a 300 metre net site area rule, which is not proposed. Meaning, if I had a 900 metre site and I could take my average 1 to 300 density, I could do 3 units, but I could possibly configure those as 3 very small terrace houses at the front of my site, leaving most of my site at the back completely vacant.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you understand to be a difference between having a density limit of 300 metres versus a minimum net site area of 300 metres?
Yes, I think the way that I see it is that each residential dwelling needs to have 300 square metres assigned to it.
So you see that as a net site area requirement?
Yes.
Okay. If I put it to you that that's not what the provisions do you still support them? Or do you feel the 300 metres is only as portable if it's a net site area control?
What do you suggest that they're doing instead if they're not doing that?
But the plan has a density requirement of 1 per 300,
yes.
But it doesn't say at all each house has to have its own 300. So if someone wants to leave the back of their section vacant in the hope that they can do a long-term future subdivision sometime in the future, they could take their 3 units, but there's nothing in the plan that says what individual site areas any of those units should have.
Right.
So they could be potentially proposed at densities higher than the median density limit of 250, which is stated in the site area requirements in that zone.
Mm.
So I'll be honest, one of the things I'm struggling with is why in some zones there are minimum net site area requirements and in others it's just a density.
Yeah, in that case I see where you're coming from and I think that it's important that each dwelling has its 300 square metres.
And one of the consequences of that is that it does effectively maintain the detached suburban house type outcome, doesn't it?
Yes. Which I think is appropriate for low density residential living.
Thank you. Well, that was going to be my next question to you. Was I probably couldn't think of anywhere else in the country, including the big smoke up in Auckland where I'm from, where people would describe 300 metre sites as low density. So what am I missing? What's the difference between 300 metres being low density and a minimum of 250 being medium density, is it?
I think with the gentle development proposal and limiting the height, so you're only going for single storey dwellings, that to me is a compromise that makes the low density thing work. And I think higher density would be multiple level.
Back in the old days of resource management, there was this concept of environmental creep and the idea that someone tried to pursue the practice of getting multiple resource consents. That was naughty, and integrated management meant you just did your consent in one go where possible. But it seems now it's become quite mainstream to get a consent and then lodge a further consent or a section 127 and then further consents on the appropriate, it would have to be said, basis of the risk of development, the cost of development, the need to get some certainty, which then brings in the investment stream, then you can go to stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. And I'd imagine in your experience, you
have a consultant, I can confirm that's
very common. So what I wanted to ask you is, what is your take on the reality of how the provisions will work in practice? So, again, I've got a 900 square metre site. I could do 2 at 450 vacant sites, or through a, let's hope, not too convoluted resource discretionary consent, I can get three at 300. So you think in the first instance there's a pretty serious advantage for people getting that consent to get the extra limited to 5.5 metres.
Yeah.
But once I get my consent and then I get my subdivision, what's to stop me just getting a new consent to go above 5.5 metres on the basis of I comply with the height of boundary control, I comply with the site yard setback, I give myself internal written approval from my newly subdivided sites. And in reality, how safe is this 5.5 metres that it's actually going to be?
Yeah, I think when, I'm not an architect, but when you design a house, I think it makes sense to design a house with a view to what you're actually building, and design and build that house as it is. And it brings a lot of additional cost in to add a whole new story to the house.
I was thinking more of the very common practice in this part of the world of people buying things off the plans and then giving themselves a new resource consent for their site before it's even been built. But anyway, we're speaking, I think, so sure, appreciate your view, and that's what I'm asking for. Related to the 5.5 metre height limit, it does mean you go from a 450 metre site at a site coverage, two-storey house, down to a 300 metre site with a same site coverage but proportionally smaller floor area, but only one level. And it seems like that's quite a jump in potential house volume for someone. Over double the size of a house on the 450 metre site down to the single level. So what I'm saying is, I can understand the single story 5.5 metre rule, but should the site coverage be bigger to bridge that gap of house size? It seems like you're getting very heavily penalised as a homeowner.
No, I think there's just a clear option. There's an alternative. You can either take your 450 and go for two stories, or you can go for 300 and go for single story house.
Mm.
Cool.
Okay.
Story.
Okay, well, thanks. That's the best
that's
way.
That's what I said.
That's all good.
Yes, sir? Yes. I'm a commissioner, but I'm also a councillor. Sorry, I was up until last Saturday. When we floated some of these changes, and we floated before the proposed district plan was drawn up, there were some areas that were marked as a change from low density to medium density. And there was quite a reaction to that from some of those areas. So we had gentle density came in and they were removed from being medium density. And there was still some kickback coming on the grounds that this is a trick. You've changed it from converting it to medium density and now you've changed the rules, so you're going to get pretty much what you want anyway. Would you have any comment on that?
If it's a trick, I've been hoodwinked as well, because I don't see it as being a trick. It seems like a good compromise to the district's problems, that everybody wants to be able to have space for their house. The developers are wanting to make developments and construct houses, and all it seems to be doing is giving alternatives. Which and the alternatives that seems to be outlined by the district plan rules seem like they're going to have reasonably low. I mean, they're going to be fitting with the policies of maintaining the spaciousness and the amenity values in the streetscape and things like that. So I think the way that the rules have been drawn up look pretty reasonable from the outset. Take Mr. Munro's point about the density and perhaps there's some work to be done there, but I think that gives a good compromise.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sutherland. Very helpful.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Bullock.
afternoon. My submission is quite simple, shouldn't take too long. I originally submitted on large lot residential zoning in support of that zoning change. I think it makes a lot of sense. Makes the best out of our current infrastructure and urban growth patterns that had naturally occurred over the last decade or so since our last district plan. So I'm still in support of my original submission, but since then there has been the S42A report that's come out, which has proposed that we take the large lot and break it down into two types, A and B. One recognising that there is a 4,000 square metre minimum as a permitted activity, I think it's permitted, or discretionary. And then there's a 2,000 square metre option, pretty much the same sort of rules. So we've got two variances between the square metre rates. That report is also identified, and it's mainly along Aspiring Road and towards part of Meadowstone. And so it's identified some of the areas within that large lot residential zone as being acceptable to be for the smaller lot size, 2,000 square metres. It's also identified the majority of Far Horizon as being substantially developed already. And with that development and the placement of the houses and the type of the houses, it's not considered that the smaller 2,000 squares would effectively be any use within the Far Horizon subdivision, and I would tend to agree with that as well. But what I'm suggesting in my revised submission is there are some areas along Aspiring Road on the south side, which is the high side, that are opposite low density residential and would provide a natural flow from that low density residential, which is effectively close to the top of Bill's Way and Rip and Lee, coming back down towards town. That's that low density residential. And it would provide a natural flow from that zone type to the large lot residential at the 2,000 square metres, which currently is proposed to exclude those sections and leave them in the 4,000 zone. And then it would transition up through to Far Horizon. So I think there's a natural progression. I think these sections have just been missed because there's not that many of them. But I think it would be a good use of the land. I think it would provide a natural flow to the urban character within that area. So that's what I've referenced within my revised subdivision. Is that the rules that apply, whether it's A or B, whichever way around it is, that the 2,000 square metre section rule should apply to those sections that I've identified on the map. I haven't actually taken it all the way to the west because some of those blocks are much larger and they form or are adjacent to a very rural part of the nature. So I don't think the transition is very good there, but I think pretty much where I've hashed out there does make more effective use, and they should be included when defining those large lot residential sections which come under the 2,000 square metre rule. I've also noted that a low density within Rip and Lee is nearly 20 metres away from the front of that section that I've lodged. So driving up Mount Aspiring Road, you've got low density residential on your right hand side. Then on the other side of the road, the current suggestion is it should stay as 1 acre blocks, 4,000 square metres, which doesn't seem to actually help the natural progression. Interested in your comments.
You won't get our answer immediately.
No, I know, I won't get an answer. Actually, I bought a form for you to say.
Could you just clarify, the lots that are on Mount Aspiring, that that adjoin Mount Aspiring Road on that section from Far Horizon Drive up to Bill's Way, do they get their access off Bramwell Close?
No, they do not.
They're off Mount Aspiring Road.
They are totally off. To the best of my knowledge, Bramwell Close, I don't know if it was actually ever lodged as a legal road. I always thought it was a private road, which got a name. But no, all the access for those sections come off either private driveways or off Aspiring Road. And some of those sections do have a legal right to come off the internal roading structure within Far Horizon, if you're asking that. So if there was further subdivision on some of those blocks, if they were further developed, some are undeveloped, some are larger with a single dwelling on them currently. But yes, if I kind of guess where you're going to, you can get access from within Far Horizon legally.
Well, thanks. I take it, not in any way disparaging, you're a resident, you're not a particular expert in any field.
I've got many t-shirts, but yeah. I'm not an expert in
that. Well, I take it just so you know,
I'm a resident.
If any question I ask, you're not confident of your answer,
yep.
Just say so, there's no
absolutely.
That's the only reason I ask. So the council proposed to us, yep, a large lot with an initial zone, and then it's come back and said maybe some of them should be 4,000, some of them should be 2,000. Mm. And what that's done for us is it's given us, not a pickle, but we then have to figure out, well, what ones should be 2,000 and what ones should be 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the council's experts have given us something of a steer, which is one option. But as a resident, if you had been asked to figure out, not just for the particular interest you, but of all that proposed large lot zone, and someone says to you, how do you figure out which ones should be kept at 4,000 and which ones would be 2,000? What are kind of things you think would help make that decision?
As a long-term resident and somebody who would like to see the sprawl contained and good use of infrastructure and being pragmatic, I'd make it all 2,000.
Right. Well, that was one question I was going to ask you, so you jumped to that well, but I was actually going to ask you, you know, why would you not at least go all the way along there in terms of
yep, what's yep, I can, but the majority yeah. of that are Far Horizon.
Yeah, and I understand.
But if it was me, and I was in your position, or a planner's position, I mean, I know why that planner said, oh, Far Horizon has been developed and the majority of those 46 sections are already occupied, etc., etc. But it makes the rules hard. It makes it difficult for planners, it makes it difficult for applicants if you've got rules that break things down. So if there is anything left in Far Horizon, let them go down to 2,000 squares. There's a couple of sections that are left in there, and it wouldn't harm the transition, it wouldn't harm the urban growth at all. Visually it would still be fine. 4,000 squares is a large block, and there are some of those blocks that in that some of them get much bigger, but you know the majority is sort of just below 2 acres. They're sort of in the sevens, something like that, down to fours. So some of those sevens could be broken up as well. Right now, if they come under the 4,000 square metre rule and they're at seven, theoretically you've got to go through a process. But if the two is applied to the whole lot, I don't see how it would be a problem, to tell you the truth.
I think at this point it might be fair to advise you that I own a property which is zoned large lot residential.
Me too.
But it's 1,995 square metres.
Okay. Right.
So I understand what 2,000 square metres looks like.
Yeah.
I just have to put it out the window.
Yeah. Do you think it's fair?
I would happily live in an apartment, so that's rather a fair question.
Yeah. I know what it takes, somebody who has a bit of free time, to maintain a section that is just under 2 acres. And I think it would be, and the curtilage that we've got around the house would, you know, probably come to about an acre. So I'm getting close to being forced off a property that I can't maintain probably in the next 10 years unless I want to spend a lot of money on private gardeners and things like that. And it would be one of the bigger blocks this close to town, one of the last few. And I personally, I think it's much better used if we make those sections smaller.
Okay, well, no more questions from me. Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Board.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Lawrence King and I'm a resident in Wanaka. And I may consider talking today about the residential zone. I think I was very, very concerned when we got the document with all the confusion, the confusing documents and the contradictions that I felt often contradicted other things that they said in the later on. And I felt that the purpose of the zone set out what the ordinary citizens expected, but it wasn't carried through with the policies. And some of them which said that the objective was the zone provides for low density residential living, but then it goes on to say that they're to allow higher densities and to allow low rise discrete infill housing. And I feel that and the other one, which was really concerning, was generally discourage commercial development, except where it's small. Now, to me, that is just making an invitation to developers. And we've already seen it in the residential area. And residents really appreciate having a residential area, knowing exactly what is expected and what they get. And this is really quite upsetting to a lot of people. We've already got in the residential area, commercial development has moved in, and for those residents who live down there where it is, they're disrupted with noise, parties, alcohol, and that should never, in our view, be accepted or allowed. I object to the rules for the activities that the residential dwelling, residential units, three or more per site, for a residential low density or coming into perhaps medium density. I feel that's far too limiting, and also licensed premises integrated within visitor accommodation development. I don't believe there's any need or any reason why licensed premises should be integrated into the residential area. One residential unit or dwelling per 300 square metre site, I believe, is too low. They say they want to bring in affordable housing for the area in the town, but the town land in the town area is very expensive already, and in one of the council publications for Scuttlebutt last year, it said that more density will allow lower property values, but they then went on to say it was a myth, because increasing densities of anything will usually promote higher land values. So you're not achieving anything by trying to lower the size of our sites in the middle of the town. Affordable housing for families is not down to that small size. Most families today, when they live in Wanaka, to live in Wanaka, most families have to, both the husband and wife both have to work, they have to have two cars, they often have two children to run around to school and sports, and that's not living for a family on a small site like that. Neither is it for elderly people, where they say it'll be for elderly people, but with the higher roofs and cutting out the sunlight, the limiting size of the windows, and lack of outdoor space, elderly people like to sit in the sun and on balconies, and this is going to not be possible if you're going to bring in such high densities, in my opinion. I also felt that the other reason is that there's no schools in our area. So why would you promote that area for families with children? And the other one that I objected to was the reduction in parking requirements. Goodness gracious, Wanaka, we all know that Wanaka has a parking problem now, so why would they reduce any parking requirements? The commercial letting of residential units or flats, I think there's already a problem, I believe, where there's no on-site management. We have motels and homestays and bed and breakfast where everything is fine, they're all controlled, but you're letting out friends of mine who have flats let near them. Often at the weekends there's parties and disruption. The other one, 8.2.10, provide for limited small-scale commercial activities. The town centre is right close by. I don't believe there's any need for commercial activities in this zone. So the things that I really object to is the four or more dwellings, licensed premises, and I don't believe, as I said before, that there's any place in a medium or low density residential area for licensed premises to be allowed. I was quite really concerned when the plan came out, and it was obvious to me that whoever looked at the plan had never considered the topography of Wanaka with the high-rising land at the back of the town. In 1976, I think it was, when they tried to put residential 2 at that time into residential 1, that was defeated by the people, and the rising land around the back of the town was used very effectively for the buildings that were high, so that they didn't obstruct anybody's view or block out the sun. So that has worked well for Wanaka, and Wanaka is really a very beautiful place to live, and it doesn't matter where we go or who we meet, if they've been to Wanaka, they all remember it. And if we can continue to have the high buildings at the back of the town and the lower buildings on the flat, I would think that that would go a long way to keeping Wanaka the way it is now and to make it still a special place. I don't think there's any room today, the way Wanaka is, to allow any, what would you call it, any ability to open the door, any rule that allows developers to come in. It's got to be secure, and it's got to be so that the people today know what they expect and know what they get when they live in a residential area. There's too much going on that is just like that. Commercial activity is generally discouraged, however, may be accommodated where necessary. Those sort of rules don't do anything for the future of Wanaka. Thank you. That was
Commissioner Gazzo, do you have any questions? Yes, we're bored. Yes, Mel Gazzo, I don't question the council of Wanaka,
yes.
But I'm also a commissioner. I'm just wondering, as a long-time local, where do you see future development in Wanaka, given there's a demand for people wanting to live here?
Well, you still have a lot of land being developed. Until that land is used up, way in the future, we may have to put up a barrier and say, this is Wanaka, this is our lifestyle reserve, and that's that. But, I mean, we have still got a lot of land being developed. Do you mean in the town area?
Yes. Oh, well, not necessarily. You were saying that you refer particularly to high density, I assume, because that's where those commercial.
This document was talking about low density as well.
Okay.
And medium density, going from low density to medium density.
Right, and that's where you have concerns about commercial,
yes,
and licensed premises.
Any residential area. Residential areas should be secure so that people know what they're getting when they buy. They shouldn't be, I don't believe, because we have a commercial area, those zones should be secure.
Okay, well, if we just move to a new zone, say North Lake, and on the plan they've got a corner K cafe, so that if anyone buys near it, they know what they're getting. Would you see that as being appropriate?
Yes, I don't see any reason why, in a, like a convenience store, or as you say, a cafe where there's a big subdivision development, but not full-scale commercialisation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you, sir. Thanks, Ms. King. I understand almost everything you've said. The one that I wasn't clear about was you talked about the existing high density zone backing onto the golf course and maybe it should stay high density.
Yes.
I've got a map here. Would it be possible for you just to explicitly show me the land you're talking about? Just I hate to agree with you and then zone too much land.
You can come up here.
Sorry.
Would it be possible just to come and show me on the map what land you think should stay high density, if that's possible?
From Chambers Street
back. I should have been a gentleman and brought them back to you.
No,
sorry about that.
That's right. Chambers Street back was always going was high density. So we've got the...
So those as well, or just those?
Well, it's all at the back of the ground.
Yeah.
It's probably all built on now, those bits there. They've got to get, you know, if you go and you can see the beautiful houses, how they're all cheered up, and they're not affecting anybody. But you start to put high levels in here. People's views are going to drop.
So it's the fact that this has got nothing behind it, they can look over the top and not blocking it. Yeah, that's totally clear with you now. Thank you for that.
Yes, but that's a problem.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. I didn't have any questions, but I should let you know I do live in Waikato, so I understand. Now, Ms. Glenna has it,
I'm not going to read my submission. I'm going to hopefully leave it for you to read later. I'm just going to talk about various bits about it. I'm mainly concerned with large lot residential. I haven't looked in detail at all the Section 42 and all those reports for the low density, medium density and high density. But I have looked at the revised chapters and they seem okay. One thing that I also submitted on that Boris has just talked about is the licensed premises within low density. It seems strange that would be suggested. The other thing is in my submission I seek a realignment of the low density large lot residential, but I think that's going to go to the mapping hearing.
Yes,
So the issue that we do now
is whether it be 2,000 minimum.
Yes, that's my main point. Yes. So I've gathered information on lot sizes, coverage and setbacks, and I was really interested to hear you're talking about density versus lot sizes, and I was confused about why some were one, some were the other. But basically the table shows there's a spectrum from high density to rural lifestyle where lot sizes increase, coverage decreases, setbacks increase. So we're talking about making the density high in the middle of town, low on the outskirts and in the rural areas. And it's controlled, as I said, through minimum lot size, coverage and setbacks. But then there's this huge leap between low density residential at either 450 or 300 square metres to 4,000 or 2,000, which is the new lot size. Like Pete Bull and I think that this zone, it's confused to me, and the full zone should be 2,000 with a couple of exceptions. So as I say, the purpose of the zone seems confused. Is it a transition between town and rural, or is it to maintain the existing density for the amenity of the current landowners, or is there some other reason? I'm just not sure. The large lot residential at 4,000 just reproduces the existing rural residential zone, although I do understand there's different controls on buildings, so I understand there's a difference, but in the main it seems to just reproduce that zone.
Isn't it fair to say that it was previously rural residential, most of it?
Most of it, so I'm going on to talk about that. So I understand that Wanaka's got this anomalous situation where rural residential and rural lifestyle are within the urban growth boundary, so it just doesn't make sense. I understand that's why probably this has been proposed. But the new zone, if it's 4,000 square metres, it doesn't actually make a change. Whether you call it rural residential or large lot residential, if it's 4,000 square metres, there's no change, other than to talk about controls on buildings, which I understand is a change. So then on my second page of my submission, I've gone through and looked carefully at what I think should be 4,000 or 2,000, but my basic thing is that the large lot residential, in my opinion, should be 2,000 throughout, and if something is considered to be better at 4,000, it should remain rural residential, but with relaxed design controls because it's within the urban growth boundary. So what I've said is, the flank of Mount Iron, I can see that there needs to be some protection of that as you rise up the hill. The Hidden Hills at the moment is a really nice subdivision with 4,000 lots, beautiful, all in amongst the Kānuka. I think that area makes sense to have 4,000 square metres, but then I say it should be rural residential in that case. There's a single identified property on Studham Road North which has natural hazards, and I see that that's a reasonable reason for having that rural residential. Other areas, I've talked about that in there, so you can read that at some later time. In conclusion, I suggest that the minimum lot size in the large lot residential should be 2,000 square metres throughout, and that would mean make the zone mean something. At the moment it's confused. And then on the third page I've listed the rules that might need to be altered if it does go to 2,000 square metres. And I've got a couple of questions once you've had questions for me.
We don't necessarily ask questions.
Clarification questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I will just to assist you. I took my fellow commissioners around this morning to visit all the large lot residential zones, so they understand what you're talking about.
Great.
For me, it's easy to say it here. With the area you referred to as Studham Road, I know the site you mean, it's a single site that runs along...
Owned by my sister, Robin.
It's along the unformed part of Studham.
Yes.
In your view, if it was to be rural residential there, should the urban growth boundary go on to the other side of it?
I think the urban growth boundary should remain on the outside of that, because part of that property has hazards.
Yes.
And part of it doesn't. So if it then gets divided, in the next... I could show you where the...
Does the zone boundary cut through the property?
No.
Well, if we're talking... If you want to quite here, it'd be much easier to know what we're talking about. We're talking about this property.
So there is actually... It's been subdivided along this line. So there's two properties. In fact, it's three.
Yeah, okay. So, if that was rural residential, would there be any reason why that urban growth boundary couldn't follow that line?
I don't think it should, because the hazard comes down here and comes across about that amount of that land. This bit has no hazard over it.
Right, so there may actually be sense for some further work there.
Yes, so maybe the next plan
review. That's fine, thank you.
And I talked to my sister about that just, and she's happy for it to remain, to be rezoned rural residential.
Did you have any questions, Christopher?
Yes,
no, it's fairly clear what you're looking for there. Thank you.
I thought your submission was great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So the question I had, it was really interesting sitting here for 20 minutes and hearing the questions that you put to other people. There were a couple of questions in the residential, the high and medium, that related to sill heights of windows on the first floor level.
I think that officers are recommending that be removed.
I haven't read that, so I was confused about that. And then the other thing, the licence premises, as Laura said, I think that's
been deleted because that was part of the visitor accommodation rules that the council was approved, as I understand it.
Okay.
So that where it came in, I don't think it's a general provision.
Yeah. And then it was interesting hearing you question Matt Sutterby about the density versus lot size, and I haven't had time to think about what that means, so I don't know what my question is to do with that, but just that I noted that you that that it is when I was going through making my table, I was going, why are some things in the density and some are in lot sizes? I can't understand what's going on here, but it seems confusing. But
We will try and rectify that.
There could well be reasons for it.
And solve the issue.
And so the other thing that relates to that is in the high density, the plot ratio versus recession plane. And again, I don't have expertise to say what's right or wrong, but I've noticed the change and wonder if it's a good idea or not. I don't know. Might well be.
Well, that's one of them.
Thank you.
Now, are you hoping to be heard now or later? I don't know who you are.
That's why.
You'll be waiting for Duncan. Right, that's fine. We will adjourn until 3:45.